The Castle by Franz Kafka, continued. Disc 7. And then we sat together behind closed windows in the July and August heat. Nothing happened. No summons, no news, no visitors, nothing.
Well, said Kay, since nothing happened and no express punishment was to be expected, what did you fear? What sort of people are you at all?
How should I explain this to you? Said Olga.
We weren't afraid of anything to come. We were only suffering from present circumstances, and were in the middle of being punished. The villagers even expected that we would come back, that father would reopen his workshop, and that Amalia, who could sew extremely beautiful clothes, if only for the most genteel, would come to take new orders. And indeed all of the villagers regretted what they had done. When a respected family in the village is suddenly cut off completely, that is to everyone's disadvantage in some way or other. They broke with us, they thought they were only doing their duty, and in their place we would have behaved no differently. And they didn't really know what it was all about. All they knew was that the messenger had gone back to the gentleman's inn, his hand filled with scraps of paper. Frida had seen him go out and come back, had exchanged a few words with him, and immediately spread what she discovered. But she certainly didn't do so out of hostility toward us, but simply out of duty, a duty that under similar circumstances anyone else would have had to assume too. And of course, as I said, the villagers would have greatly favoured a happy solution to the entire affair. If we had suddenly appeared with the news that all was now fine again, that the affair had, say, simply been a misunderstanding which had been completely cleared up, or that it was indeed an offence but had through its very commission been rectified, or that we had, through our connections at the castle, succeeded in having the affair dismissed, even this would have been enough for the villagers. They would definitely have received us again with open arms. There would have been kissing, embracing, celebrations. I have sometimes seen that kind of thing with other people. But it wouldn't even have been necessary to have such news. If we had only gone and presented ourselves of our own accord, taken up our old connections again without wasting a word about the letter affair, that would have been enough. Everyone would have gladly stopped talking about the matter. For in addition to fear, it was the painful embarrassment of the matter that had made them break with us, simply so that they would no longer have to hear anything about the matter, or speak about it, or think of it, or be in any way touched by it. If Frida had disclosed the matter, she had done so not because she took pleasure in it, but in order to protect herself and everyone else from it, to notify the community that a certain incident had taken place in our house which one should be most careful to stay away from. The issue here was not us as a family, but rather the actual affair, and we came into it only because of the affair in which we had become involved. So if we had simply come out again, let the past rest, shown through our behaviour that we had overcome the matter, regardless of how, and if the public had been thus persuaded that whatever the entire matter might have been about, it would never be discussed again, even then everything would have been fine. We would have encountered the same old helpfulness everywhere. Even if we had only partly forgotten the matter, they would have understood this and helped us to forget it entirely. Instead, we sat at home. I'm not sure what we were waiting for, probably for Amalia's decision. She had that morning seized the leadership of the family and kept a tight grip on it. Without recourse to special actions, orders, or pleas, almost solely by means of silence. The rest of us, though, had much to discuss. There was ceaseless whispering from morning until evening, and sometimes father, in a sudden attack of fright, called me, and I spent half the night by his bedside. Or sometimes we sat together, myself and Barnabas, who at first showed little understanding of the entire matter, and ardently demanded explanations, always the same ones. He must have known that the untroubled years expected by others of his age no longer existed for him. We sat together, Kay, like the two of us now, and forgot that night had come and morning again. Mother was the weakest of us, no doubt because she had endured not only our shared sorrows, but each individual sorrow. And so with horror we observed in her changes which, we suspected, awaited our entire family. Her favourite spot was the corner of a settee. We no longer have it. It's in Brunswick's large parlour. She sat there, either, one couldn't tell which it was, dozing, or, as her moving lips seemed to suggest, conducting lengthy conversations with herself. So it was only natural that we should have gone on discussing the letter affair from all angles, in all its certain details and uncertain possibilities, constantly outdoing ourselves in an effort to devise ways to achieve a favourable solution. This was all quite natural and unavoidable, but not good. And indeed we kept getting more and more mired in the very thing we wanted to escape from. And however excellent these ideas, what use were they? None could be carried out without Amalia. They were only preliminary deliberations, meaningless because the results never even reached Amalia. and if they had, they would have met with nothing but silence. Well, fortunately, I understand Amalia better now than I did then. She bore more than the rest of us. It's incomprehensible that she bore it and is still living among us today. Mother did, perhaps, bear all our sufferings, but she bore them because they had befallen her and didn't bear them for long. One cannot say that she still somehow bears these sorrows today, and even then her mind was confused. But Amalia not only bore the sorrow, she also had the sense to see through it. We saw only the consequences. She saw the cause. We hoped for some little remedy or other. She knew that everything had already been decided. We had to whisper. She merely had to keep silent. She stood face to face with the truth and lived and endured this life, then as now. How much better things were for us in all our misery than for her. Still, we had to leave our house. Brunswick moved in. They allotted us this cottage, and in several trips we brought our property here in a handcart, Barnabas and myself pulling, Father and Amalia helping out behind. Mother, whom we had brought here first, always greeted us, sitting on a crate with low wails. But I remember that even during those strenuous journeys, which were humiliating, since we often met harvest wagons whose occupants fell silent on seeing us and looked away, we, Barnabas and I, couldn't refrain from discussing our worries and our plans. Sometimes we came to a stop as we spoke, and it took Father's "Hey!" to remind us of our duty. But even after the move, all those discussions did not change our life, except that we now gradually began to feel the poverty. The subsidies from our relatives ceased, our means were almost exhausted, and just then the contempt, as you know it, began to develop. People noticed that we hadn't the strength to extricate ourselves from the letter affair and held this very much against us. It wasn't that they underestimated the grave nature of our fate, although they did not know exactly what it was. If we had overcome this, they would certainly have honoured us accordingly, but since we hadn't succeeded, they made definitive what they had done only temporarily till then. They banished us from all circles, knowing that they themselves probably wouldn't have withstood the test any better, but that it was all the more necessary to make a complete break with us. They no longer spoke of us as people. Our family name never came up again. If they had to talk about us, they called us after Barnabas, the most innocent among us. Even our cottage fell into disrepute, and if you examine yourself, you'll have to admit that on first arriving here, you too thought that you noticed the justification for this contempt. Later, when people began coming to see us again, they turned up their noses at the most trivial things. For instance, that the little oil lamp was hanging over the table. Where else should it hang, if not over the table? But to them, that was intolerable. Yet if we hung the lamp elsewhere, it still didn't lessen their aversion. Everything that we were and possessed met with the same contempt. Chapter 19. Petitioning. And what did we do meanwhile? The worst we could have done. Something that would have provided better justification for their contempt than did the actual cause. We betrayed Amalia. We tore ourselves away from her silent command. We couldn't keep living like that. We couldn't live completely without hope. And in our own way, each of us began to beg or to storm the castle in an effort to make it forgive us. But we knew that we couldn't make amends. We also knew that the only hopeful connection we had with the castle, namely through Sortini, the official who had a fondness for Father, had been blocked for us precisely through these events. Nevertheless, we set to work. Father began. There began the senseless petitions to the chairman, secretaries, lawyers, clerks. Generally, he was not admitted. And if, by means of deception or chance, he actually was admitted, how we cheered and rubbed our hands at such news. Then he was dismissed with extreme speed and never admitted again. Besides, it was so easy to answer him. The castle always had an easy time of it. What did he want? What had happened to him? What did he want to be pardoned for? When and by whom had a finger ever been raised against him at the castle? He was indeed impoverished, having lost his customers and so on. But this had to do with everyday life, with trade matters and the marketplace. And was the castle supposed to take care of everything? But in reality, it did take care of everything. Yet it couldn't crudely intervene in developments for no reason other than to serve the interests of one individual. Should it, say, send out its officials and have them pursue Father's customers and lead them back to him by force? But, Father then objected, we carefully discussed all these matters at home beforehand and afterward, squeezed into a corner as though hiding from Amalia, who noticed everything but let us carry on. But, Father then objected, he wasn't actually complaining because of his impoverishment. Everything he had lost here he would easily make up for again. All this would be beside the point if they would only forgive him. But what should he be forgiven? They said. No complaint had been filed.
At least there was no mention of it in the depositions, or at least not in the depositions open to the legal community, and consequently, in so far as could be determined, no action had been taken against him, nor was there one under way. Perhaps he could name an official decree issued against him. Father could not. Or had an official organ intervened? Father knew nothing of that. Well, if he knew nothing and nothing had happened, what did he want? What could one forgive him? At most, he was now senselessly pestering the offices, but that's precisely what was so unforgivable. Father wouldn't give up. He was still very strong then and had plenty of time because of his enforced idleness. "I shall restore Amalia's honour. It won't take much longer," he would tell Barnabas and myself several times a day, but only softly, for Amalia wasn't supposed to hear this. Nevertheless, it was said merely for Amalia's benefit, for in reality he was not at all thinking of winning back her honour, but only of securing forgiveness for her. But to obtain pardon, he first had to establish guilt, and that's precisely what they denied him at the offices. He hit on the idea, and this showed that his mind had grown feeble, that they were concealing his guilt because he wasn't paying enough. Till then he had paid only the fixed fees, which were very high, at least for our circumstances. But he thought that he had to pay more, and that was certainly wrong, because even though bribes are indeed accepted in our offices for the sake of simplicity and to avoid needless talk, they don't get you anywhere. But if that was Father's hope, then we had no wish to upset it. We sold what we still had, almost everything was indispensable, to provide Father with the means to pursue his inquiries. And then for a long time we had each morning the satisfaction of knowing that when Father set off in the morning, there were at least a few coins in his pocket for him to jingle. Of course, we were hungry all day, whereas all we achieved with the money was to keep Father in a certain state of joyous hope. But this was hardly an advantage. He tormented himself on his rounds, and so what would have come to a well-deserved end, had it not been for the money, dragged on in this way. Since in reality they could not offer us anything special for the overpayments, a clerk occasionally tried to do something for us, at least ostensibly, promising investigations and hinting that certain leads had been found that would be pursued not out of duty, but merely as a favour to Father. Instead of becoming more sceptical, Father became ever more gullible. He came back with a clearly meaningless promise, as though he were restoring the full blessing to our house, and it was painful to see him standing behind Amalia's back with his contorted smile and wide-open eyes, gesturing toward her to indicate to us that the rescue of Amalia, which would surprise nobody more than Amalia herself, was, thanks to his efforts, imminent, but that all of this was still a secret which we should keep strictly in confidence. This would certainly have gone on for a long time if we hadn't discovered that we could no longer provide Father with money. Barnabas had been taken on as an assistant by Brunswick after much pleading, but only in such a way that each evening he collected the orders in the dark and delivered the finished work in the dark. It is true, for our sake Brunswick had exposed his business to certain risks, but he paid Barnabas very little for that, and Barnabas's work is flawless. Yet the pay was barely enough to save us from real hunger. With much care and after a great deal of preparation, we announced to Father that our financial assistance had been terminated, but he took this calmly. His powers of reason were now such that he could no longer understand the futility of his interventions, but he had grown weary of the continual disappointments. Although he said, he no longer spoke as clearly as before, he used to speak almost too clearly, that he would have needed very little more money, because tomorrow or even today he would have found out everything, but now everything had been in vain, and it was only because of the money that it had come to naught and so on, his tone of voice indicated that he didn't believe a word of this. And then suddenly he had new plans. Since he hadn't succeeded in establishing guilt, and therefore couldn't get any further through official channels either, he would have to resort exclusively to begging and approach the officials in person. Surely there were some among them who had good, compassionate hearts, which they admittedly could not give into at the office, but outside the office they could, if you surprised them at the right moment. At this, Kay, who had been absorbed in listening to Olga, interrupted the story by asking, "And you think that's mistaken?" True, the rest of the story would have to give him the answer to this, but he wanted to know at once. "No," said Olga, "there can be no talk of compassion and the like. Young and inexperienced as we were, we knew this, and Father also knew it, of course, but he had forgotten it, this and most other things. He had prepared a plan to post himself on the main road near the castle, where the officials' carriages went by, and then, if at all possible, to present his appeal for forgiveness. Frankly, it was a plan quite devoid of reason, even if the impossible had come about and the appeal had actually reached the ear of an official. For is an individual official capable of granting pardon?
At best, this might be a matter for the administration as a whole, but even it is incapable of granting forgiveness. It can only judge. But even if an official wanted to give in and deal with the affair, could he form an impression based on what Father, the poor, weary, aged man, muttered to him? The officials are highly educated, but only one-sidedly so. In his own area, an official can, on hearing a single word, dart at once through complete trains of thought. But if someone explains cases from another department to him for hours on end, he may nod politely, but he won't understand a word. Well, all this is obvious. Just try to understand the minor official affairs concerning you, the tiniest things, which an official settles with a shrug. Just try to understand them fully, and you'll be busy all your life and never get to the end. But even if Father had managed to find an authorized official, the latter cannot settle anything without the preliminary files, and certainly not out on the road. In other words, he cannot forgive. He can only dispatch matters officially, and to this end can only refer back to official channels. But Father's attempts to achieve anything in that way had already ended in utter failure. How far downhill things must have gone for Father if he thought he could get anywhere with this new plan. Had there been even the remotest possibility of the sort, the road would be teeming with petitioners. But since this was a sheer impossibility, as even the most elementary schooling ought to make one realize, the road is completely empty. Perhaps this, too, strengthened Father's hope. He found nourishment for it everywhere. There was a great need for that, too, for a healthy mind wouldn't have to get involved in such lengthy reflections. From the most superficial details, it would recognize the sheer impossibility of the endeavor. When the officials drive to the village or back to the castle, it isn't really a pleasure trip. Work awaits them in the village and at the castle, which is why they drive at top speed. Nor does it occur to them to look out the carriage window to search for supplicants. The carriages are crammed with files, which the officials are busy studying.
"Still," said Kay, "I have seen the inside of an official sleigh, and there were no files there." The world unfolding to him in Olga's story was so large, almost unbelievably so, that he couldn't refrain from touching it with his meagre experience in order to persuade himself more clearly of its existence as well as of his own.
"Well, that is possible," said Olga. "But then it's even worse, since the official has such important concerns that the files are too valuable or too voluminous to be taken along. Such officials give orders to drive at a gallop. In any case, nobody has time to spare for Father. And besides, there are several approaches to the castle. At times this one is fashionable and most drive there, at others that one, and everyone rushes in that direction. The rules according to which these changes take place are still unknown. At 8 o'clock in the morning, all of them may be travelling on a certain road. Half an hour later, all are on a different one. 10 minutes later, on a third. Half an hour later, back on the first, which they then remain on all day. But at any moment, this may change. True, all approach roads merge near the village, but by then all carriages are speeding along, whereas near the castle the pace is somewhat more moderate. But just as the sequence of departures in relation to the roads is irregular and inscrutable, so too is the number of carriages. Indeed, there are often days when there's not a single carriage to be seen, but there soon are throngs of them out driving again. And just think of Father having to cope with all this. In his best suit, soon his only one, he sets off each morning from the house accompanied by our blessings. He takes along a small fire company badge, which he has kept illicitly, so that he can pin it on outside the village. He's afraid to show it in the village itself, though it's so small you can barely see it 2 paces away, and yet to Father's mind it's even supposed to be able to draw the attention of passing officials. Not far from the entrance to the castle is a market garden. It belongs to one Bertuk, who supplies the castle with vegetables. There, on the narrow stone pedestal of the garden fence, Father selected a place for himself. Bertuk tolerated that because he had been friends with Father and had been one of his most faithful customers. He has a rather crippled foot, you see, and believed that only Father was capable of making him a boot that fit. Father sat there day after day. It was a bleak, rainy fall, but he was utterly indifferent to the weather. Each morning, at a certain hour, he put his hand on the latch and waved goodbye. In the evening, each day he seemed more stooped. He returned completely soaked and threw himself in a corner. First, he described his little experiences. For instance, that Bertuk had thrown him a blanket over the fence out of compassion or old friendship, or that he thought he had recognized one or other official in a passing carriage, or that a coachman would recognize him from time to time and jokingly flick him with his whip. Later he stopped telling us these things. He had obviously given up hope of accomplishing anything there. He merely considered it his duty, his dreary vocation, to go and spend the day there. That was when he started getting rheumatic pains. Winter was coming. Snow fell early.
The winters here begin very early. Anyhow, he sat there, first on the rain-drenched stones, then in the snow. At night he gasped with pain. In the morning there were times when he wasn't sure whether he should go, but then he overcame his reluctance and went. Mother clung to him and did not want to let him go, so probably out of anxiety over his no longer compliant limbs, he let her go with him. And then before long, Mother too was racked with the same pains. We often went to see them, brought them food, or simply visited them, or tried to persuade them to return home. How often we found them there, slumped on their narrow seat, leaning on each other, crouched in a thin blanket that barely covered them, with only the grey of snow and mist for surroundings, and no person or carriage anywhere about. What a sight, Kay, what a sight. Until one morning Father could no longer get his stiff legs out of bed. He was inconsolable. In the delirium of a light fever, he thought that he saw a carriage halt up at Bertuk's, an official get down, look for Father at the fence, shake his head angrily, and go back to the carriage. Meanwhile, Father let out screams as if he were determined to make the official up there notice him, so that he could explain the blamelessness of his absence. And it turned into a long absence. He never went back. For weeks he had to remain in bed. Amalia took over all care, services, treatment, everything, and indeed, with a few breaks, she has kept it up to this day. She knows medicinal herbs that ease the pains, needs almost no sleep, is never startled, fears nothing, never becomes impatient. She did all the work for our parents. Whereas we were unable to do anything to help and fluttered about uneasily, she remained cool and calm throughout. But when the worst was over and Father was able to work his way out of bed, carefully, supported on both sides, Amalia immediately withdrew and left him to us.
Chapter 20. Olga's Plans.
Then we had to find some occupation for Father that he could still do. Anything that would at least support him in his belief that his work served to shift the guilt away from the family. Finding something like that wasn't difficult, for anything, essentially, could match the effectiveness of sitting outside Bertuk's garden. Yet I found something that gave hope even to me. Each time the question of our guilt was raised in offices, by clerks or elsewhere, there was only talk of the insult to Sortini's messenger. Nobody dared to probe any further. Well, I said to myself, if people in general know only of the insult to the messenger, even if only seemingly so, then it would be possible, again, even if only seemingly so, to make amends for everything if we succeeded in appeasing the messenger. Of course, no complaint arrived, as has been stated, nor has the matter been taken up by any agency. And so the messenger is, in his capacity as an individual, and that's all that matters here, free to forgive. All of this couldn't possibly be of decisive importance, was merely an illusion, might once again lead nowhere, but still it would please Father. And in this way one might almost manage, perhaps even to his satisfaction, to drive into a corner the numerous information givers who had tormented him. But first, of course, the messenger had to be found. When I told Father of my plan, at first he became very annoyed. You see, he had become extremely stubborn, partly in the belief, which had come to him during his illness, that we had always prevented him from obtaining final victory, first by ending his subsidy and then by keeping him in bed, and partly because he was no longer capable of grasping the ideas of anybody else. I had not even come to the end of my story when my plan was rejected. He believed that he had to continue waiting at Bertuk's garden, and that we should take him there in the handcart because he would no longer be able to climb up there every day. But I didn't relent, and gradually he became reconciled to the idea. All that disturbed him was his complete dependence upon me, since I was the only one who had seen the messenger at the time. Father didn't know him. Of course, one servant resembles the next, and even I wasn't entirely sure that I could recognize that one. Then we began to go to the gentleman's inn to look among the servants there. True, he had been a servant of Sortini's, and Sortini no longer came to the village. But the gentleman often switched servants. We could surely find him in some other gentleman's group, and even if we didn't find him, we might be able to gather information about him from the other servants. To that end, we would have to spend every evening at the gentleman's inn, and we weren't particularly welcome anywhere, especially not in a place of that sort, and of course it wasn't possible for us to go there as paying guests. But as it turned out, they actually were able to find some use for us. I'm sure you know what a torment the servants were for Frida. Mostly they are on the whole quiet people. The easy work makes them spoiled and ponderous. May you fare like a servant is how officials wish somebody well, and it's said that when it comes to the good life, the servants are the true masters at the castle. They certainly do know how to appreciate that, and while at the castle, where they must move about under its laws, they are calm and dignified, I have heard various reports confirming this, and even among the servants here you find traces of it, but only traces, because in the village the laws of the castle are no longer entirely applicable to them. They seem transformed, having turned into a wild, unruly horde, governed not by the laws but by their insatiable drives. Their shamelessness knows no bounds. It's lucky for the village that they can leave the gentleman's inn only upon orders, but at the gentleman's inn itself one has to try to get along with them. Well, Frida found that very difficult, so she was very glad she could use me to calm the servants. For over 2 years now I have spent the night in the stable with the servants, at least twice a week. Earlier, when Father was still able to go to the gentleman's inn, he slept somewhere in the taproom, waiting for the news that I used to bring in the morning. It was little enough. To this day we haven't found the messenger we sought. They say he's still working for Sortini, who has high regard for him. The messenger must have followed Sortini when he withdrew to more distant offices. The servants haven't seen him any more recently than we have, and if one of them insists that he has, then it's probably a mistake. So my plan might seem to have failed, but that isn't quite so. We haven't actually found the messenger, and the treks to the gentleman's inn and the night spent there, and perhaps even his compassion for me, if he's still capable of any such thing, have unfortunately almost finished off Father, and he has been in the condition in which you saw him for almost 2 years. But he may be faring better than Mother, whose end we expect each day, for it's been postponed only thanks to the superhuman efforts of Amalia. But what I did manage to do at the gentleman's inn was establish a certain connection with the castle. Don't despise me if I say that I don't regret having acted as I did. But what could that important connection to the castle possibly be, you may be asking yourself? And you're right, it certainly isn't an important connection. But I have come to know many servants, the servants of almost all the gentlemen who have come to the village over the last few years, and if I do reach the castle some day, I won't be a stranger there. Of course, that was only the servants in the village. They're completely different at the castle, and probably wouldn't even recognize anyone anymore, especially not someone they have associated with in the village, even if they had sworn 100 times in the stable that they were eagerly anticipating a reunion at the castle. Besides, I know from experience how little all such promises mean. But that certainly isn't the most important thing. It's not only through the servants themselves that I have a connection with the castle, but perhaps also hopefully in such a way that whoever is observing me and my actions from up there, and managing the large staff of servants is of course an extremely important and vexatious part of official work, that the person observing me in that manner will perhaps reach a milder verdict about me than anyone else would. Perhaps he will recognize that I too am fighting, no matter how miserably, for the sake of our family, and am continuing Father's efforts. If that is how they see things, then perhaps I will also be forgiven for accepting money from the servants, and for using it for our family. And I accomplished something else, though you blame me for this too. I found out from the domestics that it is possible, for instance, in roundabout ways, without difficult official application proceedings, to enter the castle services. But then you're not an official employee, only a secret semi-probationer. You don't have rights or duties. It's harder not having duties, though you do have some, since you're close to everything and can notice favourable opportunities and take advantage of them. You aren't an employee, but then by chance some kind of work can turn up. Just then there's no employee around. Someone cries. You hurry over, and the very thing that a moment ago you were not, namely an employee, you then become. But when can such opportunities be found? Sometimes right away. You have barely entered, barely looked around, and the opportunity is already at hand. But it is not everyone who already has, as a novice, enough presence of mind to immediately seize the chance. At other times this takes years longer than the proceedings for public admission, and for such semi-probationers there's no possibility whatsoever of a regular public admission. So a good many doubts arise. But they become moot, since the candidates for public admission are most painstakingly selected, and any member of a family found to be in any way disreputable is immediately rejected. If such a person subjects himself to this proceeding, for instance, and spends years trembling about the outcome, everyone will ask in astonishment how he could dare to attempt anything so pointless. But he does have hope, for otherwise how could he live, though after many years, perhaps as an old man, he learns that he was rejected, finds out that all is lost and that his life was in vain. Of course, here too there are exceptions, which is why one is so easily tempted. It sometimes happens that it's precisely those disreputable people who are finally accepted. There are some officials who, very much against their own will, love the smell of that sort of wild game. And during admission exams they sniff the air, twist their mouths, roll their eyes. Men like that somehow seem to stir their appetite, and they must cling to the law books in order to be able to resist. But sometimes that doesn't help the man gain admission, but only endlessly prolongs the admission proceedings, which are not terminated, but simply broken off after the man dies. Thus both the legal admission and the other kind are full of open and hidden difficulties, and it certainly makes sense to weigh everything carefully before getting mixed up in anything of that sort. Well, we did not fail to do so, Barnabas and I. Each time I came from the gentleman's inn, we sat down together. I talked about my latest discovery. We discussed it for days, and it wasn't good that the work in Barnabas's hands went untouched for so long. And here I may be at fault from your point of view. After all, I knew the domestic stories weren't very reliable. I knew that they never had the slightest desire to tell me about the castle, and always diverted attention elsewhere. They made us beg for each word. But of course, once they got going, they let rip, talked gibberish, bragged, outdid one another with exaggerations and fabrications, so that the constant shouting everybody took turns at inside the dark stable must have obviously at best contained only a few meagre hints of the truth. I told all this to Barnabas, just as I had seen it, and he, who was still utterly incapable of separating truth from lies, and, because of our family circumstances, almost thirsted with longing for these matters, drank everything in and glowed with fervour for more. And my new plan did indeed rely on Barnabas. No more could be accomplished through the domestics. Sortini's messenger was not to be found, and would never be found. Sortini, and therefore his messenger too, seemed to have receded ever farther. People had often forgotten their appearance and their names, so I often had to describe them at length, with no result other than that they remembered them with great difficulty, but that's all they could say about them. And as far as my life with the domestics was concerned, I had no say, of course, in how they pronounced judgment on it, and could only hope that they would take that episode in the spirit in which it had been engaged in, and therefore deduct a small part of our family's guilt, but I got no outward signs of that. Still, I kept it up, since I could see no other possibility of our accomplishing anything at the castle. For Barnabas, though, I could see a possibility of that sort. From the domestic stories I could deduce, if I wanted to, as I certainly do, that anyone who is admitted to the castle services can accomplish a great deal for his family. But then, of course, how credible were these stories? That was impossible to determine, but I knew it was little enough. For if, say, I was solemnly assured by a domestic, whom I would never see again or would hardly recognize even if I did, that he would help my brother find a position at the castle, or at least support him if Barnabas were somehow to enter the castle, say by providing him with refreshment, for according to the stories the domestics tell, in the course of the excessively long waiting periods, it does happen that applicants for positions faint or become confused, and then they are lost, unless their friends watch out for them. When these warnings alerted me to such matters, and much else besides, they were probably justified, but the promises accompanying them were absolutely empty. But not for Barnabas, whom I cautioned against believing in such promises, but even the mere mention of them won him over to my plans. The examples I gave didn't greatly impress him. He was far more impressed with the stories of the domestics. And so I was actually thrown back on my own resources. No one except for Amalia could get through to our parents. The more I pursued father's old plans in my own way, the more Amalia cut herself off from me. She still speaks to me in front of you and others, but not when the two of us are alone. For the domestics at the gentleman's inn, I was a plaything, which they kept trying to break. Throughout those 2 years I have never said an intimate word to any of them, nothing but dissimulation, lies, or craziness. So I had only Barnabas to turn to, and Barnabas was still very young. While informing him of all this, I noticed the gleam in his eyes, which he still has. I was startled, but didn't give up, for I thought the stakes were too high. True, I didn't have the great, if empty, plans of my father, and I also lacked the determination that men possess. I stuck to the task of making amends for the insult to the messenger, and even wanted to get credit for my modesty. But what I had failed to do alone I now wanted to achieve through Barnabas in a different and more secure way. After we had insulted a messenger and driven him from the front offices, we took what was surely the most natural step and offered them a new messenger in the shape of Barnabas, who would carry out the duties of the insulted messenger, and thus make it possible for the insulted party to bide his time quietly someplace, at some remove, for as long as he wanted, for as long as he needed to forget the insult. But I fully realized that, for all its modesty, this plan wasn't lacking in presumption, for it might seem as though we wanted to dictate to the authorities how they should settle personnel matters, or as if we doubted that the authorities were capable of arranging everything in the best way through their own devices, and had even made arrangements long before it dawned on us that anything could be done here. But then again, I thought it impossible that the authorities should misunderstand me in that way, or, even if they did, that they would do so intentionally, that they would, in other words, reject everything I do from the outset, without further scrutiny. So I didn't relent, and Barnabas's ambition took care of the rest. During the preparations, Barnabas became so arrogant that he began to feel that a shoemaker's job was too dirty for a future office employee like him. And on those rare occasions when Amalia spoke to him, he even had the audacity to contradict her outright. I didn't begrudge him this short-lived joy, for, as could easily have been foreseen, on the very first day he went to the castle, his joy and his arrogance instantly disappeared. It was the start of that apparent service I've already told you about. It was astonishing that Barnabas had no difficulty entering the castle, or rather the office which has become his workplace, as it were. This success almost made me go mad. The moment Barnabas whispered me news of it when he came home, I ran to Amalia, grabbed her, pressed her into a corner, and kissed her with lips and teeth, causing her to weep in pain and fright. I was so agitated I couldn't say a word. Besides, we hadn't spoken to each other in a long time. I therefore put off the conversation for a few days. But of course, over the next few days, there was no reason to talk. After those rapid gains, that was it. And then for 2 years Barnabas led that monotonous, wrenching life. The domestics let us down completely. I gave Barnabas a short letter to take along, commending him to the care of the domestics, whom I at the same time reminded of their promises. And whenever Barnabas saw a domestic, he pulled out the letter and held it up in front of his eyes. And though he had probably come across domestics who didn't know me, and though his way of showing the letter without saying a word, he doesn't dare to speak up there, irritated my acquaintances, all the same it was shameful that nobody helped him, and it was a deliverance, which we admittedly could have brought about a long time ago on our own, when a domestic, who may have several times had the letter thrust at him, crumpled it up and threw it into a wastebasket. It even occurred to me that he could almost have said, "After all, you treat letters the same way too." But however fruitless this entire period, it had a positive effect on Barnabas, if one wants to describe as positive his aging before his time and prematurely becoming a man, in some ways earnest and insightful beyond manhood itself. It often saddens me to look at him and to compare him with the youth he was even 2 years ago. And yet I do not get from him any of the consolation and support that he might be able to give me as a man. Without me, he would hardly have got into the castle, but ever since going up there he has become independent of me. I'm the only one he confides in, but he probably tells me only a fraction of what he has on his mind. He tells me a great deal about the castle, but from his stories, from the little facts he discloses, it's impossible to gather how this can have so greatly transformed him. It is especially difficult to understand why up there, as a man, he has so completely lost the courage which, when he was a boy, was enough to drive us to despair. Of course, this futile standing around, this waiting around over and over again for days on end without any prospect of change, is wearying and fills you with despair, and finally even makes you unable to do anything better than stand around in desperation. But why didn't he resist earlier? Especially since he soon noticed that I had been right, and that there was nothing there to further his goal, though one could probably take advantage of certain things to improve our family's lot. For up there everything, except for the whims of the servants, is quite modest. And since ambition seeks fulfilment in work and the task itself becomes paramount, eventually all ambition disappears. There is no reason to indulge in childish wishes there. Still, Barnabas was convinced, he told me, that he could clearly see how power and knowledge were wielded even by those rather dubious officials whose rooms he could enter. How they dictated, quickly, with half-closed eyes and brief gestures. How, only with their index finger, wordlessly, they dispatched the surly servants who, breathing heavily at such moments, smiled happily, or how they found an important passage in their books, pounded on it, and the others, insofar as this was possible in the confined space, ran up and stretched their necks out toward it. Such things gave Barnabas exalted ideas about these men, and he had the impression that if he advanced far enough to be noticed, and could exchange a few words with them, not as a stranger, but as an office colleague, if only of the most subordinate kind, then it would be possible to obtain unforeseen benefits for our family. But things have simply not yet gone that far, and Barnabas doesn't dare to undertake anything that might take him closer to that goal, though he is keenly aware that within the family, because of the unfortunate circumstances and despite his youth, he has moved up and taken on the heavy responsibility of acting as the head of the family. And there's one other thing I must confess. It has been a week now since you arrived. I heard someone say so at the gentleman's inn, but paid no attention to it. A land surveyor had come. I didn't even know what that was. But the following evening, Barnabas comes home earlier than usual. At a set time I used to go to meet him part way, and seeing Amalia in the room, he pulls me out onto the street, presses his face down on my shoulder, and weeps for several minutes. He has again become the little boy he once was. Something has happened to him, and he's clearly no match for it. It's as if a completely new world has opened up before him, and he cannot stand the happiness and worries stemming from the novelty of it all. And yet all that happened to him was that he received a letter to deliver to you. Still, it is the first letter, the first task he has ever been given." Olga broke off. It was quiet, except for her parents' heavy and at times rattle-like breathing. Kay said casually, as if elaborating on Olga's story, "You put on a show for my benefit. Like an old harried messenger, Barnabas delivered the letter, and you as well as Amalia, who for once sided with you, pretended that the messenger service and the letters were simply something on the side."
"You must distinguish between the two of us," said Olga. "Those two letters made Barnabas a happy child again, despite all his doubts about his task. He confesses these doubts only to himself and to me, but he wants to find honour in your eyes by acting like a real messenger, the way he thinks real messengers act. And therefore, to give you one example, despite his increasing hope of obtaining an official suit, I had to tailor his trousers within 2 hours, so that they would at least resemble the tight-fitting trousers of the official clothing, and he could pass muster in front of you, who in that respect are, of course, still quite easy to deceive. So much for Barnabas. But Amalia really despises the messenger service, and now that he's apparently had some minor success, which she can easily detect from the way Barnabas and I sit about whispering, she despises it even more than before. She is therefore telling the truth. Don't ever fool yourself by doubting that. Kay, if I sometimes disparaged the messenger service, it was not with any intention of deceiving you, but out of fear. The two letters that have passed through Barnabas's hands so far are the first, if still rather doubtful, signs of favour that our family has received in 3 years. This change, if it actually is a change in fortune rather than an illusion, illusions are more common than changes in fortune, is connected to your arrival here. Our fate has become somewhat dependent on you. Perhaps these two letters are only the beginning, and Barnabas's occupation will soon go beyond delivering messages dealing with you. Let's hope so, for as long as we can. But for now, everything is aimed solely at you. Up there we have to be satisfied with whatever they assign us, but down here perhaps we can do something for ourselves as well, namely, assure ourselves of your favour, or at least preserve ourselves from your dislike, or, most important, protect you to the best of our ability and experience so that you don't end up losing your connection to the castle, which we might be able to live on. What would be the best way to bring this about? So that you're not suspicious of us when we approach you, for you are a stranger here, and are no doubt filled with suspicion about everything, filled with justified suspicion. Besides, people despise us, and you're influenced by that prevailing view, especially through your fiancé. So how should we get through to you without, for example, however unintentionally, opposing your fiancé and hurting your feelings? And the messages, which I read carefully before you received them, Barnabas didn't read them, as a messenger he wouldn't allow himself to do so, first seemed quite unimportant, obsolete. They undermined their own importance by referring you to the council chairman. And how should we treat you in that regard? If we stressed their importance, we would make people suspect that we were overrating something that was obviously so unimportant, merely so as to recommend ourselves to you as the bearers of this news, and to pursue our own ends instead of yours. And in the end we might even devalue the news in your eyes, and in that way, very much against our will, deceive you. But if we didn't attach much importance to the letters, we should make ourselves just as suspect. For why were we taking the time to deliver these unimportant letters? Why did our behaviour contradict our words? Why were we deceiving not only you, the addressee, but our employer, who certainly hadn't handed us the letters so that we would go and make statements that might lessen their value for the addressee? And staying in the middle between the exaggerations, that is, weighing the letters correctly, is impossible. Their value keeps changing. The thoughts that they prompt are endless, and the point at which one happens to stop is determined only by accident, and so the opinion one arrives at is just as accidental. And if fear for your sake comes into this too, then everything becomes confused. You shouldn't judge these words of mine too harshly. If, for instance, as actually happened once, Barnabas comes with the news that you're dissatisfied with his service as a messenger, and that he himself has, in the initial shock, and unfortunately not without showing some sign of a messenger's testiness, offered to resign from this service, then I could, in order to make amends for the error, deceive,
lie, swindle, and do absolutely any bad thing if it would only help. But then I'm doing it, at least that's what I believe, as much for your sake as for ours."
Someone knocked. Olga ran to the door and unlocked it. A streak of light from a covered lantern breached the darkness. The belated visitor asked questions in a whisper and received answers in a whisper, but wasn't satisfied with that and tried to force his way into the room. Olga evidently couldn't hold him back any longer and therefore called Amalia, obviously in hopes that Amalia would, in an effort to protect her parents' sleep, do anything to get rid of the visitor. And she actually did hurry over, push Olga aside, step out into the street, and shut the door behind her. It took only a moment. She came back right away, having quickly accomplished what Olga had been unable to do. Kay then learned from Olga that the visit had been intended for him. It had been one of the assistants who had come to look for him on instructions from Frida. Olga had tried to shield Kay from the assistant. If Kay wanted to confess his visit here to Frida later on, he was free to do so, but it shouldn't be discovered by the assistant. Kay gave his approval. But he declined Olga's offer that he spend the night here waiting for Barnabas. He might have accepted this on its own merits, for it had already become quite late, and it seemed to him that he was now so connected to this family, whether he wanted to be or not, that a night's lodgings here, though perhaps embarrassing for other reasons, would, because of that connection, be the most natural place in the entire village for him. Nevertheless, he refused. The assistant's visit had startled him. It was incomprehensible to him that Frida, who knew what he wanted, and the assistants, who had learned to fear him, should have teamed up again in such a way that Frida even went so far as to send an assistant for him, but only one. The other must have stayed behind with her. He asked Olga whether she had a whip, but she did not have one, though she had a good willow switch, which he took. Then he asked whether there was any other exit from the house. There was one such exit through the courtyard, only then you had to clamber over the fence of the next-door garden and cross that garden before you came to the street. Kay resolved to do so. While Olga was leading him across the courtyard to the fence, Kay attempted to calm her worries by explaining that far from being angry at her because of the little tricks in her story, he actually understood her quite well and wished to thank her for the confidence she had in him, which she had demonstrated through her story. He instructed her to send Barnabas back to the schoolhouse the moment he returned, even if it was still dark. Though Barnabas's messages weren't his only hope, otherwise he would be in a bad way, he certainly didn't want to give them up. He wanted to hold on to them without forgetting Olga. Almost more important to him than the messages was Olga herself, her bravery, her prudence, her cleverness, and her sacrifices for her family. If given a choice between Olga and Amalia, it wouldn't take long to decide. And he pressed her hand warmly as he swung himself up onto the fence of the garden next door. Once he stood out on the street, he saw, insofar as he could see anything at all on this bleak night, the assistant walking back and forth up there outside Barnabas's house, sometimes coming to a halt in an effort to shine a light through a curtained window into the room. Kay called out to him. Without seeming at all startled, he gave up spying on the house and came toward Kay. "Who are you looking for?" asked Kay, testing the suppleness of the willow switch on his thigh. "You," said the assistant, coming closer. "Well, who are you?" Kay suddenly said, since it did not seem to be the assistant. He seemed older, wearier, more wrinkled, but with a fuller face. Even his gait was completely different from the assistant's, which was nimble, as though their joints were electrified. He walked slowly, limping slightly, elegantly infirm. "You don't recognize me," said the man. "I'm Jeremias, your old assistant." "Oh?" said Kay, pulling out the willow switch which he had hidden behind his back. "But you look quite different." "That's because I'm alone," said Jeremias. "When I'm alone, carefree youth is gone." "So where's Arthur?" asked Kay. "Arthur?" asked Jeremias. "The little darling. He has given up his duties. But you were a little too harsh with us. The delicate soul couldn't stand it. He went back to the castle and is filing a complaint against you." "And you?" asked Kay.
"I was able to stay," said Jeremias. "Arthur is filing the complaint for me, too."
"What are you complaining about?" asked Kay.
"We are complaining," said Jeremias, "that you cannot take a joke." "Now then, what did we do? Joked a bit, laughed a bit, teased your fiancée a bit? And all this, by the way, in accordance with instructions. When Galata sent us to you..."
"Galata?" asked Kay.
"Yes, Galata," said Jeremias. "He was Clam's substitute at the time. When he sent us to you, he said... I remember, since that's what we're referring to, you're being sent there as assistants of the surveyor. We said, but we don't know anything about that kind of work. At that, he said, that isn't so important. If it becomes necessary, he will teach you. But it's important that you should cheer him up a bit. From what I hear, he takes everything very seriously. He has come to the village and right away thinks this is some great event. But in reality, it's nothing at all. You should teach him that.
Well, said Kay, was Galata right, and did you carry out your instructions?
I don't know, said Jeremias. In that short time, it may not have been possible. All I know is that you were very crude, and that's what we're complaining about. I don't understand how you, who are only an employee, after all, and not even a castle employee at that, can fail to see that this kind of duty is hard work, and that it's very wrong to make the work even more difficult for the worker, in a willful, almost childish manner, as you have done. How thoughtless it was of you to leave us freezing at the fence, or again how, on the mattress, you struck Arthur an almost mortal blow. Arthur, someone who feels the pain of a cross word for days. And how that afternoon you chased me back and forth in the snow in such a way that I needed an hour to recover from the mad rush. After all, I'm no longer young.
Dear Jeremias, said Kay, everything that you're saying is right. Only you should raise this matter with Galata. He sent the two of you here of his own free will. I didn't request you from him. And since I didn't ask for you, I was free to send you back, and would rather have done so peacefully than by use of force, but that's clearly how the two of you wanted it. By the way, when you first came to me, why didn't you speak as openly as you do now?
Because I was on duty, said Jeremias, but that goes without saying.
And you're no longer on duty? Asked Kay.
No longer, said Jeremias. Arthur has given notice at the castle, or at least the procedure is under way and should free us at last.
But you're still looking for me as though you were on duty, said Kay.
No, said Jeremias. I'm looking for you only to reassure Frieda. When you left her because of the Barnabas girl, she was very unhappy. Not so much at the loss as at your having betrayed her, though she had seen it coming a long time and had already suffered a lot because of it. I had just come back to the schoolhouse window to see whether you mightn't have become more reasonable. But you weren't there, only Frieda was, sitting on a school bench, weeping. So I went up to her and we came to an understanding. And everything has already been taken care of. I'm a room waiter at the Gentleman's Inn, at least while my case at the castle remains unresolved, and Frieda is back in the taproom. It's certainly better for Frieda this way. It made no sense for her to become your wife. Besides, you could not appreciate the sacrifice she was willing to make for you. But the good woman is having second thoughts. Perhaps she actually wronged you. Perhaps you weren't really at Barnabas's. Even though there was, of course, no doubt at all as to your whereabouts, I came here to establish conclusively that that was indeed the case. For after all that great excitement, Frieda finally deserves a good night's sleep, as do I. So I came here and not only found you, but on the side also noticed the way those girls are at your beck and call. Especially the black-haired one, a real wildcat, put herself out for you. Well, each to his own taste. In any case, there was no need for you to make that detour through the next-door garden. I know that path.
Chapter 21. Well, so it had actually happened, as one could have foreseen, but there was no way it could have been prevented. Frieda had abandoned him. This wouldn't have to be final. It wasn't that bad. Frieda could be won back. She was easily influenced by strangers, even by those assistants, who thought that Frieda's position resembled their own and who, since they had given notice, caused Frieda to do so too. But Kay need only go up to her, remind her of everything that spoke in his favour, and she would once again be his, would even be full of remorse, especially if he could justify the visit to the girls with the success that he owed to them. But despite these thoughts with which he sought to calm himself with regard to Frieda, he was not calm. Just a little while ago he had boasted to Olga about Frieda, calling her his only support. Well, it was not the most stable kind of support. Stealing Frieda from Kay did not require the intervention of some powerful figure. All it took was this not particularly appetizing assistant, whose flesh sometimes gave one the impression that it wasn't quite alive. Jeremias had already begun to leave. Kay called him back.
Jeremias, he said, I want to be very open with you, and so do answer the question I have honestly asked. Our relationship is no longer that of master and servant, and I'm as pleased by that as you are, and so we don't have any reason to deceive each other. And now, before your very eyes, I will break this switch which was meant for you, for it wasn't out of fear of you that I chose the path through the garden, but in order to surprise you and to take a few swipes at you with the switch. Well, don't hold it against me any more. That's all over. If you weren't a servant imposed on me by the authorities, but simply an acquaintance of mine, we would certainly have got along extremely well, though your appearance sometimes bothers me a little. And we could certainly make up for all the things of that sort that we've neglected.
You think so? Said the assistant, and, yawning, he rubbed his weary eyes.
Well, I could tell you about it in greater detail, but I haven't time. I must go to Frida. The dear child is waiting for me. She hasn't begun her duties yet, for at my request the landlord gave her a little time to recuperate. She wanted to throw herself into the work right away, no doubt as to forget everything. And that time at least we want to spend together. As for your proposal, I certainly have no reason for lying to you, but just as little reason for confiding anything in you. You see, the situation is different for me than it is for you. As long as my relationship to you was an official one, you were, of course, a very important person to me. Not because of your own qualities, but because of my official instructions, and I would have done anything for you at the time. But now I couldn't care less about you. I'm not moved by your having broken the willow switch, either. That only reminds me what a callous master I had. It's hardly likely to win me over. "You speak to me," said Kay, "as though it were very certain that you need never fear anything from me again. But that is not so. You're probably not rid of me yet. They don't reach decisions that quick here. Oh, sometimes even quicker," Jeremias threw in. "Sometimes," said Kay. "But nothing points to that having happened this time. At any rate, neither of us has a written decision. So the proceedings have only just begun, and I haven't even intervened in them yet with the help of my connections, but I will do so. If the results are not in your favour, then you certainly won't have done much to predispose your master in your favour, and perhaps there was no need for me to break the willow switch. True, you carried off Frida, and that especially is what has given you a swollen head. But I must say, despite all my respect for you as a person, even if you no longer have any for me, that if I addressed a few words to Frida, it would be enough, I'm sure, to rip apart the lies with which you've ensnared her. And only lies could draw Frida away from me."
"Threats like that don't frighten me," said Jeremias. "You don't want me as an assistant. You even fear me as an assistant. You are particularly fearful of assistants. It was only out of fear that you hit dear Arthur."
"Perhaps," said Kay. "But did it hurt any less because of that? Perhaps I will often be able to show my fear of you in the same way. If I see that your assistantship isn't giving you much joy, I will, despite all that fear, take the greatest pleasure in forcing you to do your duty. And indeed, this time I shall make a point of getting hold of you alone, without Arthur, and then I can devote special attention to you."
"Do you really think," said Jeremias, "that I have even the slightest fear of any of that?"
"I certainly do," said Kay. "You certainly fear me a little, and, if you're clever, a great deal. If not, why haven't you gone to Frida? Tell me, are you fond of her?"
"Fond?" said Jeremias. "She's a good and also clever girl, a former mistress of Clam's, so she's definitely respectable. And if she keeps asking me to rescue her from you, why shouldn't I oblige her, especially since it doesn't do any harm to you, who consoled yourself with the accursed Barnabases?"
"I see your fear now," said Kay. "What a miserable fear it is. You're trying to ensnare me with your lies. Frida asked only one thing of me, that I should rescue her from those frenzied and doggishly licentious assistants. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to do all she asked, and the consequences of my omission are now there."
"Surveyor! Surveyor!"
someone was shouting up the street. It was Barnabas. He was out of breath, but did not forget to bow before Kay.
"I succeeded," he said.
"What did you succeed in doing?" asked Kay. "You have presented my request to Clam?"
"Oh, there was no way that could be done," said Barnabas. "I tried very hard, but it was impossible. I pushed my way forward, and without being asked, spent all day standing so close to the desk that a clerk in whose light I was standing even pushed me away. Each time Clam looked up, I announced my presence by raising my hand, even though that is forbidden, stayed in the office longest, was the only one left with the servants, had once again the pleasure of seeing Clam return, but it wasn't for me. He merely wanted to check something else in a book quickly and then went away again at once. And in the end, the servant, seeing that I still hadn't moved, took his broom and almost swept me out the door. I'm admitting all this so you won't be dissatisfied with my accomplishments again."
"Barnabas, what good is all your diligence to me," said Kay, "if you had no success at all?"
"But I did have some success," said Barnabas. "As I stepped from my office, I call it my office, I see a gentleman coming from the corridors deeper inside. The entire place was already empty. It was already very late. I decided to wait for him. It was a good opportunity to stay a bit longer there. Besides, I would rather have stayed there than bring you the bad news. But for other reasons, too, the gentleman was worth waiting for. It was Erlanger."
"You don't know him?" "He's one of the first secretaries of Clam, a short, frail gentleman with a slight limp. He recognized me at once. He's well known for his memory and for his ability to judge people. He simply knits his brow. That's all it takes for him to recognize anyone, often even people whom he's never seen before, whom he has only heard or read about. And in my case, for instance, he could hardly have seen me before.
But though he recognizes everyone right away, he asks first, as though he were unsure. "Aren't you Barnabas?" he said to me, and then he asked, "You know the surveyor, don't you?" And then he said, "That's convenient. I'm going to the gentleman's inn. The surveyor should visit me there. I'm in room 15. But he would need to come at once. I have only a few meetings there and go back tomorrow morning at 5. Tell him that I set great store on speaking to him." Suddenly Jeremias took flight. Barnabas, who in his agitation had barely noticed him, asked, "What is Jeremias up to?" "Trying to beat me to Erlanger's," said Kay, who ran after Jeremias, caught up with him, took his arm and said, "Was it the longing for Frida that suddenly overcame you? It's no less strong in me, so we'll go there in step." Standing in front of the dark gentleman's inn was a small group of men. Two or three were holding lanterns in such a way that some faces were recognizable. Kay found only a single acquaintance, Gerstecker, the coachman. Gerstecker greeted him with a question. "You're still in the village?" "Yes," said Kay. "I came here for good." "That's really no concern of mine," said Gerstecker, coughing loudly, and he turned toward the others. It became clear that they were all waiting for Erlanger. Erlanger had already come, but was still negotiating with Momus before receiving the parties. The general tenor of the conversation concerned their not being allowed to wait in the building and having to stand outside in the snow. It wasn't very cold, to be sure. Nevertheless, it was inconsiderate to keep the parties standing in front of the house at night, perhaps for hours. That wasn't, of course, the fault of Erlanger, who was, on the contrary, most obliging, probably did not know about it, and would certainly have been quite annoyed had it been reported to him. It was the fault of the landlady at the gentleman's inn, who, in her already quite pathological striving for refinement, couldn't bear to have a large number of parties coming into the gentleman's inn at the same time. "If it's really necessary and they must come," she often said, "then for heaven's sake always only one by one." And she had seen to it that the parties, who at first had simply waited in a corridor, later on the staircase, then in the corridor, and finally in the taproom, were ultimately pushed out onto the street. And even that wasn't enough to satisfy her. She found it unbearable being, as she put it, constantly under siege in her own house. She couldn't understand the point of holding office hours for the parties. "To dirty the front steps of the inn," an official had once said in response to a question from her, most likely in anger, but to her the remark seemed very convincing, and she liked to quote it often. Her goal, and here her aspirations coincided with the wishes of the parties, was to see that a building was built across from the gentleman's inn where the parties could wait. She would have much preferred that the meetings with the parties and the interrogations be held outside the gentleman's inn, but the officials opposed this idea, and anything that was seriously opposed by the officials was naturally unattainable for the landlady, though in minor issues she succeeded through her indefatigable but at the same time femininely delicate zeal in exercising a kind of minor tyranny. The landlady would probably have to continue to endure the meetings and interrogations at the gentleman's inn, for while in the village, the castle officials refused to leave the gentleman's inn on official business. They were always in a hurry, for it was only very much against their will that they were in the village. They hadn't the slightest desire to prolong their stay here beyond what was absolutely necessary, and so it wasn't reasonable to expect that they should, simply for the sake of ensuring peace and quiet at the gentleman's inn, temporarily move into some house across the street with all their writings and thereby lose time. The officials far preferred to discharge their official business in the taproom or in their own rooms, if at all possible during a meal or from their beds before going to sleep, or in the morning when they were too tired to get up and wanted to stretch out in bed a little while longer. On the other hand, the question of whether to construct a building for the waiting parties seemed about to be resolved. Still, it was quite a severe punishment for the landlady. People had a good little laugh over this, that the waiting room issue required many meetings and that the corridors of the inn were rarely empty. All these matters were discussed in a low voice by those waiting outside. Kay found it remarkable that, though there was a great deal of dissatisfaction, nobody had any objection to Erlanger's summoning the parties in the middle of the night. He asked about this, and was informed that one ought to be grateful to Erlanger for that. It's only his goodwill and the exalted idea that he has of his office that makes him come down to the village in the first place, for he certainly could, if he wanted to, and that might be more in accordance with the regulations, send some under-secretary and get him to take the depositions. But he usually refused to do that. He wanted to see and hear everything for himself, but was obliged to sacrifice his nights for that purpose, since no time was set aside in his official schedule for journeys to the village. Kay objected that, after all, Clam also came to the village during the day, and even stayed for days at a time.
Was Erlanger, who after all was only a secretary, more indispensable up there? A few laughed good-naturedly, others remained silent out of embarrassment. The latter soon gained the upper hand, and Kay barely received an answer. Only one of them responded hesitantly by saying that Clam was naturally indispensable, in the castle as well as in the village. Then the front door opened and Momus appeared, flanked by two servants carrying lamps. "The first to be admitted to see Secretary Erlanger," he said, "are Gerstacker and Kay. Are those two here?" They answered, but Jeremiah slipped ahead of them, saying, "I work here as a room waiter," was greeted with a smile and a slap on the shoulder by Momus and entered the house. "I must pay closer attention to Jeremias," Kay told himself, while remaining aware that Jeremiah was probably far less dangerous than Artur, who was working against him at the castle. Perhaps it was even wiser to let them torment him as his assistants, rather than have them prowling about unchecked and freely engaging in intrigues for which they seemed to have a special talent. As Kay went past, Momus pretended that he had only just noticed it was the surveyor. "Oh, if it isn't the surveyor," he said. "The gentleman who so disliked being interrogated is now pushing his way into an interrogation. It would have been far easier with me back then. But, of course, it's difficult to choose the right interrogations." Kay was about to stop in response to this remark, but Momus said, "Go, go. Back then I could have used your answers, but not now." In spite of this, Kay, agitated by Momus's behaviour, said, "You're thinking only of yourselves. Simply for the sake of the office I won't answer, either then or now." Momus said, "Well, whom else should we be thinking of? Who else is here? Do go." In the corridor they were received by a servant who led them along the path already known to Kay, across the courtyard and then through the gate into the low, slightly sloping passageway. The upper floors were evidently occupied only by the higher officials, and this corridor here only by the secretaries, including Erlanger, though he was one of the highest-ranking in their midst. The servant put out his lantern, for there was bright electric lighting in here. Everything here was small but delicately built. Full advantage had been taken of the space. The passage barely sufficed for walking upright. On the sides, one door came immediately after the next. The side walls didn't reach the ceiling. This was probably to ensure ventilation, for the little rooms in this deep cellar-like corridor surely had no windows. The drawback of these walls that didn't quite meet the ceiling was the noise in the corridor, and therefore, inevitably, in the rooms, too. Many rooms seemed occupied. In several of them people were still awake. One could hear voices, hammer blows, clinking glasses. But this didn't leave one with the impression of great merriment. The voices were hushed. One could barely understand a word every now and then. But it didn't seem like conversation. It was probably only somebody dictating something, or reading something aloud. And it was precisely from those rooms giving off the sound of clinking glasses and plates that one couldn't hear a word. And the hammer blows reminded Kay of something he had been told somewhere, namely, that in order to recuperate from the constant mental effort, some officials occasionally took up cabinet-making, precision tool-making, and the like. The actual corridor itself was empty, except for a spot by a door where sat a pale, slender, tall gentleman in a fur coat, with his nightclothes showing underneath. The room had probably become too stuffy for him, so he had sat down outside, where he was reading a newspaper, though not attentively. He often gave up reading with a yawn, then leaned out and looked along the corridor. Perhaps he was expecting a party whom he had summoned and who had failed to come. After they had passed him, the servant said to Gerstacker concerning the gentleman, "Pinzgauer." Gerstacker nodded. "He hasn't been down in a long time," he said. "Not in a very long time," confirmed the servant. Finally, they came to a door no different from the others, but behind which, so the servant reported, lived Erlanger. Having asked Kay to lift him up on his shoulders, the servant looked in through the narrow opening on top. "He's lying on the bed," he said, climbing down. "He has his clothes on, but I think he's dozing. Sometimes he is quite overcome by weariness here in the village, because the way of life is so different. We will have to wait. When he wakes up, he'll ring. There have been times when he has slept through his entire stay in the village, and then when he woke up he had to go back at once to the castle. In any case, it's voluntary, the work he does here." "If only he would choose to sleep through to the end," said Gerstacker, "for when he wakes up again and finds he has little time to finish his work, he's quite indignant at having slept, and tries to expedite everything in a hurry, and one can hardly discuss one's concerns." "You've come because of the assignment of haulage contracts for the building?" asked the servant. Gerstacker nodded, pulled the servant aside, and spoke quietly to him.
But the servant was barely listening. He was looking out over Gerstecker, whom he towered over by more than a head, while earnestly, deliberately stroking his hair.
Chapter 22. At that moment, Kay, who was looking around aimlessly, saw Frieda some distance away at a bend in the corridor. She pretended not to recognize him, merely fixed her gaze on him. In one hand, she held a tray with empty dishes. He said to the servant, who did not pay the slightest attention to him, the more you spoke to the servant, the more absent-minded he seemed to become, that he would be back at once, and ran to Frieda. When he reached her, he grabbed her by the shoulders as though seizing possession of her again, and asked some trivial questions while looking quizzically into her eyes. But her rigid posture scarcely relaxed. Distractedly, she tried to rearrange the dishes on the tray and said, "What is it you want from me? Just go to those... You know their names. You've just come from them. I can tell from the way you look." Kay quickly changed the subject. That discussion shouldn't begin so suddenly, nor with the worst matters, with those least favourable to him. "I thought you were in the taproom," he said. Frieda looked at him in astonishment, then ran her one free hand gently over his forehead and cheek. It was as if she had forgotten what he looked like, and wanted to recall it that way. Her eyes, too, had the blurred look of somebody trying with great difficulty to remember something. "I've been taken on for the taproom again," she said slowly, as if what she was saying was not important, but beneath the words she was holding a conversation with Kay, and this was what was important. "This work doesn't suit me. Anybody could do it. Anybody who can make beds and put on a friendly face and does not fear being pestered by the guests but even invites it. Any such person can be a chambermaid. But in the taproom it's somewhat different. I was immediately taken on in the taproom again, though I didn't leave it all that honourably earlier, but of course now I had patronage. But the landlord was glad that I had patronage, and that it was therefore easy for him to take me back. They even had to pressure me to accept the post. If you think about what the taproom reminds me of, you'll have no difficulty understanding that. In the end, I accepted the position. But I'm only here temporarily. Peppy asked me that she not be obliged to endure the disgrace of having to leave the taproom right away, and since she did her work diligently and saw to everything, to the extent that this was possible with her limited abilities, we have given her a 24-hour extension."
This book is continued on Disc 8.